Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I've been teaching at University of Ottawa. My status has gone up. I'm a university teacher. And it was a series of four meditations. And we finished on Thursday, graduation day. And the guy that organized it had certificates for everyone. I found that such a hoot. Because we don't really get certificates. There it is. We just keep working at this. One of the questions that people often ask is Buddhism a religion? And this word religion is such a fraught word now that a lot of people don't want to be associated with it because it's a word that has unfortunate connotations of abuse and warfare and on the negative sense, superstition, hypocrisy, and so on. So, actually, in the Buddhist tradition, at the time of the Buddha, there was, from what I can tell, there really wasn't a word religion as such. It was more, whose teaching do you follow? I follow Mahavira. I follow Gotama. So it's more of a sense that everyone was doing some kind of practice. And they were following the tradition of a particular teacher. A good way to look at Buddhism is to think of it as Buddhist religions. I like that kind of academic way of looking at that, because there are so many manifestations of what we call Buddhism in the world, just as there are manifestations of the Abrahamic religions. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the same you have with Buddhism. So if you have Pure Land or Vajrayana or Theravada, these are different schools or cultural forms of what we call Buddhism. So it's not really monolithic. But one thing that all the schools will agree upon is that Buddhism is a practice. That it is a doing, that it is a cultivation, that it is a craft. I think that everyone will agree upon. So say, we this monastery is from a very Orthodox Theravada tradition from the tradition of forced monasticism in Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka in South Asia. And the Orthodoxy also, that's the kind of word that can have a lot of negative connotations because it sounds like the most uptight, conservative bit of spirituality that exists. And orthodoxy, usually in traditional religious language, was also combined with the word orthopraxy, that there is a practice to this. There isn't just a set of beliefs which are blindly held. So the idea of practice is paramount, is important. And if you don't have that in Buddhism, then you just have some views and opinions. But getting back to the word religion, it's a word that comes through Western culture and beyond our sort of political perceptions of that, or the root of the word religio is the sense of binding yourself to something, like ligaments, bind the body. So in that sense, it can be a positive word where you give yourself to something. You give yourself to a certain structure of practice to understand the deeper parts of human consciousness. And this way it can have a very wholesome perception. It's hard to take a word which has so many negative perceptions and make it wholesome. And maybe I'm fighting a losing battle here, but so if you think about I don't know what word do we have in English where you have a tradition, where we have a tradition of iconography, we have a tradition of art, we have a tradition of chanting, we have a tradition of monasticism and interaction with the laity. What do you call that? Anthropologists will call it religion. But again, many Westerners, they don't want to be labeled religion, so we call it spirituality. Spirituality, somehow, that word doesn't fit the whole idea of a tradition, and a tradition which is practiced and honored and cultivated. So you could have an orthodox tradition, but if you didn't have orthopraxy, if you didn't have the real practice, then of course it could become superstition. It can just become, well, my mom did it, that's why I do it. And then it becomes a kind of cultural artifact which might be quite comfortable around Vesak and so on, but it wouldn't really liberate. It could be fun. Or it could be superstitious, or it could be just a sort of duty-bound thing. So orthopraxy, practice, is very, very important. So what do we mean by practice? Well, it seems that the Buddha, before he would really teach meditation, he would really inquire into the person's level of consciousness, to the way they lived socially, the way they acted in the world, and he would kind of see that did they see the benefits of generosity. So that was one of the first things he taught: the benefits of generosity, the good heart, the benefits of goodwill. And if a person saw that and lived that and saw the importance of that, then the structures of a moral life would be kind of introduced. So then, obviously, from a sense of goodwill and generosity, one cares for the one is concerned about the well-being of others, the safety of others, other beings. And the Buddha made it very broad: all beings, all creatures, all sentient beings, very, very broad. So it wasn't just humanity or my tribe. And so you start to get, like in Buddhist history, you start to get a tradition of moral precepts being practiced. So traditionally we have the five precepts. And that becomes a kind of formula that the laity take on, and quite often in gatherings, that's the way we begin. We begin with the five precepts, and that's something that one binds oneself to, one gives oneself up to. Say, like our monastic training, we have our tradition of rules, which has both moral implications and also. It's a way of ordering our community, our relationship to the laity, our relationship to each other, the way we use requisites, the renunciant parts of our life. And that's what we give ourselves up to, we surrender to. And this is very helpful because it's something which isn't just dependent on my opinion, on my viewpoint, on my preference, on my particular style that I like to follow. It's something bigger than myself. There's a sort of popular word that, like, Kadanyato used to use that, designer religion. You know, you take a bit of this and a bit of that and this kind of flavor, and you design it to your own aesthetic ways or whatever. The danger there is, of course, you design it to your own ego and your own desires. But actually having something that you can give up to and then watch yourself within that is tremendously helpful, because it acts as a mirror. And so if you think about the five precepts, the precept on not killing, just that mirror to that which is violent in the human mind, that which wants to just expunge anything which is a nuisance, just get rid of it because it's a nuisance or whatever. That impulse of ill will or impulse of greed or whatever, that's then noticed more if you have a structure that you've given up to, the structure of panatipata, the suggestion not to harm sentient beings. So that encourages goodwill. And the foundation for Buddhist enlightenment is a heart of goodwill, profoundly goodwill, profound compassion. That's the real method. So a precept structure, a traditional precept structure, then giving up to that acts as a protection for ourselves and acts as a protection to the society, the community, and acts as a mirror to those impulses which, if followed, are unskillful and do not lead to, are not the causes for peace, are not the causes for enlightenment. And that's a kind of formula that the five precepts is a formula that comes down to us and has been practiced for 2,500 years. A structure, and it has a certain kind of chanting about it that we do. We all know that. And that can be just done parrot style, or it can be done as a kind of renewing of one's intentions. And the problem with spiritual, one of the problems of spiritual life is we do forget, don't we? We kind of just keep forgetting the practice. And so resolve, just like resolving to stay with the breath for 45 minutes, it's quite hard, isn't it? You make a resolution and, you know, perfectly simple resolution, I'll just try to stay with the breath for 45 minutes and we're off. You know, off to wherever we go. Worries and plans and back again. So resolve is very important to help us remember what the path is. Now this isn't just blind belief. It's not religion as sloganeering like pro-choice or, what is the other one? It's anti-abortion, right? Pro-life, pro-choice. That's kind of sloganeering religion. That has no reflection in it. That's just political. But actually, like this reflective capacity that we have to look at ourselves, to see why we do things, to see our intentions and to see the results of our intentions, to see when the results are foundations for peace, when the results are foundations for remorse, and so on, is the practice, isn't it? It's that kind of reflective mind that we have. And so the precept structure is a way of mirroring, of helping us in that way. You think about like the second precept of honesty in the way we deal with the world. So, in our training, we have a lot of strong precepts around trying to be impeccable. So, like copying a CD which has copyright, that's commonplace. Right, to copy it, and you think, wow, what the heck, it's Sony, they've got lots of money, doesn't really matter, I'll just take a copy. And it's not, you know, it's not like the world's going to fall apart if you copy a CD, but the training of the heart, the training of the mind, oftentimes takes us to something more difficult. It's not just the easiest path, it's not the easiest just to do what I want to do. It makes my life difficult sometimes, it makes life difficult. And so, just like copyright, I just need that little piece of this and can't afford it, but then you have a mirror saying, yeah, but is that an honest thing to do? Is that honest or dishonest? Now, sometimes morality can become so excessive people can't live their lives. You know, I had a great example of that in Northumberland when I was living in a monastery in Northumberland. We had we were very broke. And we were trying to build yet another monastery, and we didn't have any heating, and we had to get, like for plumbing, we had to get steel pipes from the junkyard, and that's all we could afford, and rethread them. So it was quite a marginal living. It was good, and we had we probably had £15 in the bank or something. And we had one committee member who was really obsessed about ethical banking. And I remember one really long committee meeting about ethical banking. It must have gone on for hours. I could have done all the plumbing at the time. And I thought, yeah, but we've only got £15. You know, give me a break, will you? And this person was so obsessed with his standards of ethics that no one could live with them. It was just impossible. And they're all very logical. So that's one extreme. Yes, that's one extreme. The other extreme is kind of to have no reflection and just kind of to go by the whims of the mind and the desires of the heart and so on. If you just think about like the precept on right speech or precept on adultery and fidelity, these are very powerful kind of mirrors to help us look at states of mind which would be very unskillful if we follow them. So if you think how many have suffered remorse from wrong speech, and you say you're kind of in a you're in a bad mood, so you just dump your mood onto someone and go, oh gosh. I mean, if you're a reflective person, if you're not reflective, you just dump it on it again. Just bounce the person around. But I think we're all more reflective than that. But you do it, you see it, and that's not a good result, is it? You're just sort of mouthing off to someone because I want to mouth off to them, a kind of carelessness and heedlessness. So then, like, resolving to keep the precepts around right speech, to speak in harmony, to speak truthfully, to speak according to Dhamma, to speak beautifully, rather than to lie, to be divisive, to swear, and so on, this becomes a mirror to the intentions I have. So my speech, if I'm trying to manipulate people, or I'm trying to make myself look better to people, or I'm whatever it is, I begin to look at that. Does that intention to flatter people and have them like me all the time, does that really lead to my peace? Where's that intention coming from? So the precept offers a mirror. Yeah? And then I can watch how my mind works, why I say what I say, why I do what I do. And so they're very, very helpful. And so before the teaching would kind of move into meditation, these things have always been the foundation of the meditative contemplative life: generosity, morality, goodwill. Big things. There are big things. And so there's a tradition that encourages that, tradition of chanting and reflection, which is done again and again and again. And so that body of tradition is one way of looking at religion. If you want to use the word, if you don't want to use the word, I don't know quite what you would. I guess you'd say spiritual tradition, right? But it's a word we have in the West. So you bind yourself, religio, you bind yourself to this particular form, not because you have faith in it, but not because it's your own ego trip. I'll keep. So some people come to me and say, "Well, can I keep three?" I say, "Which three?" Or one man from Texas, he was a Laotian, came to me. He said, "You know, sometimes I really wish I was a monk." And I said, "Yeah, sometimes you wish you weren't a monk." You know, yeah, I want to be a monk when life is difficult and I can't pay for the mortgage. Thank you very much. So a structure isn't just about like having something that is just designed for my ego, is it? You know, it's something that challenges me. It challenges me to look at myself in a good way. But the importance is not the precept, it's the orthopraxy. Just blindly keeping to precept becomes a superstition, can become a conceit. Oh, I've got more precepts than you, that kind of thing. I keep 8 precepts, and it gets very, very silly. But as a mirror, orthopraxy, awareness, reflection, contemplation, cause and effect, karma, this is what orthopraxy is. So once that foundation of our lives is in place, right livelihood, right speech, right action, very important, then the meditative life proceeds much better because our minds aren't so confused, our minds aren't kind of taken up with memory and all kinds of things we've done which are confusing. And meditation is also, if you think about it, like just sitting here for 45 minutes, you bind yourself to a posture, to a room, to a time, to someone else controlling the time, right? Me. And you bind yourself to that. You don't just feel restless and then go. You don't just like stay as long as you want, do you? You kind of give up to something. And in that giving up, the structure mirrors what's going on in your mind. Oh gosh, there's pain in my hip, and should I move, should I not move? Oh gosh, I keep thinking about the mortgage, and it goes on and on. But at least the giving up to the structure helps one to see what's going on. What's the mind preoccupied? Why is it preoccupied with that? And that's that reflective capacity being cultivated. That's orthopraxy. Right practice, right doing, right effort. Yeah? And even if the meditation is difficult, one develops tremendous paramitas, tremendous virtuous qualities by giving up to something like that, giving up to 45 minutes of non-distraction, of not just doing what I want to do. And obviously, if the meditation works, and it's just a very sweet time, a lovely time to come to the silence of the mind. But sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And obviously, as one becomes more adept, it is. But that's not the point of it. You know, the point of it is the giving yourself to something, like just giving yourself to the breath, say, making that the structure of surrender. Just totally give myself to the breath. Just one out breath, just that. Very, very peaceful. Of course, the desire mind and the mind which is worried or whatever, it doesn't want to give up to that. It wants to think and organize and talk to itself. And so you end up living in these inner committee meetings, you know, these different characters that occupy your consciousness. Have you ever, you know, ever looked at that, all the different people that populate your mind? You know, there's the kind of arrogant one, there's the humble one. There's the obsequious one, there's the know-it-all. There's the one that's full of self-doubt, and there's the know-it-all. And, you know, it's like all these beings walking through your consciousness. And the beauty of the reflective mind is that you are none of those. You are not the self-doubt, you're not the arrogant one, you're not the angry one. These are simply movements of consciousness. And that, again, is orthopraxy. The practice of knowing all the committee members as simply objects of mind, rather than you being the subject of any of them. Because if you think about it, which one are you then? Are you the really humble one when you see the Ajahn? Or are you the kind of fascist when your mind goes crazy? Which one are you? You're none of them. They're just kind of conditions of mind which seem too real sometimes. So orthopraxy, this capacity to reflect and know things, becomes strengthened through meditation, through our ability to be still, to know, to just be for one out breath, just to be for one out, and you see how difficult it is, because there's always becoming, there's always this movement towards the future, brought from the past, this kind of continual restlessness of the mind. So the kind of practice, of course, it has to be done all the time. 45 minutes isn't enough. It has to be done in everything we do, all the things that we do. But the structures of right speech, the structures of restraint that we are encouraged in, help us to some extent. But then we have to make the resolve and the determination to really practice on the things that preoccupy our attention, on our obsessions, on the committee members that can take over of our minds, and we have to make strong resolutions to practice with that. And what do we mean by practice? Well, let's say I was speaking to someone yesterday who has a managerial position in a small firm and middle management engineering thing. And this person is always worried about what people think of him, what his boss thinks of him, what the workers think of him. And it's not just a kind of healthy concern. It's not quite an obsession, but it's how the sense of self gets born into consciousness. So much of the weekend is spent thinking about what people think of him. Not very productive, not very happy, tension, stress, and so on. And so then we all have that, don't we? It might be fearful, it might be just fantasizing all the time, it might be resentful, hypercritical, self-critical, you know, different kinds of things that our mind is preoccupied with. If you look at the thinking mind, how much of thinking is necessary? Most of it's not. It's just habit, isn't it? The habit of mind. And so when life is interesting or exciting or frightening, we focus on the present moment. We absorb into it. But then when there's nothing to absorb our attention, our minds just get blah, 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 going on and on and on. So then how do you practice? Well, one begins to look at the inner world as the moods of the mind, rather than as as realities, one begins to be able to reflect on thought as an object, on the mood as an object. So if my particular mood that preoccupies me is very, very critical, I'm just always critical of everything, myself and others and all that, somehow the reflective heart has to see, well, that's the critical mind. That's just the way, that's the critical, that's the way it works, that's how it's operating. And getting that distance, getting that sense of awareness is the first step in liberation. And that's awakening, isn't it? So always we're reinforcing the simple idea, well, how is it now? How is it? What is it like now, really? What is the breath really like now? Not a judgment, not a seeking of anything special. So what's the mood of the mind now? What is it really like? I shouldn't be like this, and that's not it. So you have, you know, as a Buddhist, you have kind of really idealized sense of what the mind should be. I certainly suffered a lot. I remember the first year of meditation, and I was fuming with anger about a mango or something important, and then I felt terribly guilty about the anger, and then, you know, Ajahn Sumedho said, "What's your problem?" "So, oh, so much anger. I shouldn't be angry. I should have metta for everyone. I should love everyone." He said, "Just swear." So he just told me to walk up and down a minute and just swear for a while. Sweared for 5 minutes. Oh, I see, this is anger. Became objective. Whereas my idealized young mind, oh, I shouldn't be angry. And that's not reflection. So all our shoulds and shouldn't be's are simply more members of the committee. And basically, you want to get out of that committee. It's just, you know, it's just not going to get you anywhere. It'll be one of those endless committee meetings that never end, never go to time. So just knowing, this is like self-criticism, feels this way, and beginning to abide as that witness. And then the practice is like making determinations to help you to awaken and to help you to let go, aren't they? So all of us have moods of mind, given the right factors, which tend to obsess us and take us over. And then, and we kind of see that over time. We say, yeah, that's just a pattern. And so how can I work with that? That's the kind of intention to practice. So the determination is to, how do you wake up to a pattern and know it as an object, as opposed to being the subject? So how do I awaken to self-doubt as an object of mind rather than always doubting myself? How do I awaken to criticism as an object of mind rather than being the critical person all the time, or fear or worry or whatever you like? Right? That seems to me very, very difficult. Well, you can make an intention. You can say, I'm gonna really try to notice the thinking patterns. I'm going to try to awaken to that. And the more you make those kinds of intentions, which is part of our practice, you tend to notice these things as objects. Whereas if I just hate myself and criticize myself and say I shouldn't be like that, that's not awareness. That's more ego. So like the scene in Thailand was, I was so greedy for yogurt or whatever I wanted. And the food was so very basic that I would sort of get, like, in Thailand we had 50 monks, 25 on each side of a long, long dining hall. And I was number 25 on one side, because I was a new novice. And so the food would get last to me. And I'd look up the line and see that those are Ajahns. They were getting two cakes, and I didn't get any cake. And I said, "This is not fair. I'm bigger than them." And I'd start to, you know, what kind of hypocrisy is this anyways? I mean, it should be evenly divided. And of course, the devotional side of the monk, the monks would be giving out this food, right? So you'd have these big pots of food, and then you'd have trays of sweets and so on. Well, monks would go down and slop the food in our bowls, and then they'd give us whatever. And so the young monks who were giving out the cakes, they weren't great cakes, but they were cakes. they would have so much devotion for the senior monks, like Ajahn Liam, who were wonderful beings, that they'd give them five, right? Now, there's me down the end, and I got half a banana. So then my mind would just kind of, you know, just get really critical about religion. This is absolute hypocrisy. It's not fair. And I was bigger than that. I really was bigger, and I was very thin. And so the mind goes on, blah, 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 blah. And Ajahn Chah would every night give a, not every night, but many nights, and so why do you suffer? Well, it's because you had all the cakes. What's the cause of suffering? And it just became very obvious that, well, either I'm not going to get those cakes, so either figure out suffering or get out of here. And of course, then you begin to see, yeah, it's the critical mind, isn't it? It's an object. And that's the beginning of freedom. It still goes on. So then the banana would arrive, the half a banana would arrive, and the guy next to me would get a mango. And then the mind would want to go critical. No, I'm not going. No, I'm not going there. And so, I mean, it sounds funny, but it was very painful, actually. Because it was so absurd. Here I am, I was 24, 25, 26, a grown man, right? It was, my mind was so childish. And that's the way it is, isn't it? You sort of have a self-image of maturity, and you can pull it off, maybe. You know, people think you're pretty cool. But inside, the stuff we sometimes have to look at can be pretty embarrassing. Fortunately, we don't have kind of televisions across our foreheads. But that's all right, because that's just the way the mind is conditioned. It's not who I am. It's just the way the mind's been conditioned. So I went to Thailand, I had never trained. I had just, when I was hungry, I just ate what I wanted, and go to the markets. If I didn't like the country, I'd go to another country. You know, I wasn't greedy. And then I got to Thailand, and there wasn't the access to a fridge. And there was just what they gave me. And that kind of giving up to that structure of okay, I'll just take what's offered, became actually a kind of a freedom to observe my preferences, observe the greed and anger that it conditioned as an object of mind, rather than having the possibility of pursuing my greed constantly and then actually being a victim of it. So I began to see that, wow, this incredible possibility of freedom. I don't like it. I don't really like this. I'd rather have the cakes up top or whatever it is. But I saw that's not, I've already done that. I've done my cakes. I've been there. I was so obsessed with cakes. I tell you, I had a cake dream. This is confession time. I had a cake dream, and I'd be in a like a Loblaws or something, with a shopping cart piled with cakes, and I'd get to the checkout counter and I'd be a monk. I didn't have no money. Couldn't get out. I kind of look at that. Wow, where was your mind at? But that's just what, you know, that's the untrained mind. It wasn't trained to any kind of renunciation or refinement at all. And I'd go to Ajahn Chah and he'd say, oh, this is so difficult. He'd say, well, what do you expect? You haven't trained your mind. Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot. But it was true. It was true. The mind hadn't been trained. So training the heart, I mean, obviously, most of us are older than that now, but when the obsessive conditions of mind come up, to see, well, okay, this thing that constantly preoccupies my energy, my mental energy, that if I'm always preoccupied in that way, it cannot touch the deepest silence of the heart. I cannot touch the deepest thing which is the spiritual of the heart, because my mind is preoccupied. My attention is outwards into thought and into emotion and into the past and the future. So somehow I have to learn how to be very, very present to the way things are. So the challenge of these stronger ego emotions and mindsets that we come up against is to simply bear witness to them as objects. Now our desire mind, of course, wants to get rid of them or wants to pursue them. So if you're going through some self-doubt, now that can really seem so very real and so very important. And to actually just witness to self-doubt, it's very uncomfortable. It's not pleasant at all. It's unpleasant. But to have the kind of reflection that this will change. And the mind keeps wanting to create a sense of self. Oh, I don't know, Willis Chan, I don't know if I'm doing this right, I should do something. No. And to actually bear witness to something unpleasant, rather than just seek its opposite, the pleasant. To bear witness to something unpleasant, not in the way of harming yourself, but you bear witness to it. And what happens is the desire to get rid of it, or identify with it, all that desire begins to end, and you begin to find a really deep peace in the mind, which isn't dependent on confidence and doubt. You know, it's something deeper, it's behind all of that. And these conditions of mind that we face, they're very deluding. You know, they kind of grab us and we just find ourselves thinking in these unskillful ways. And they're not real, but they are real, aren't they? They are real in the sense they have emotional power. But we do have the capacity to witness to them. So the teaching is out, like binding yourself to a teaching then is how can I remember to really use the teaching to interpret this now? So the teaching is that which has the nature to arise, has the nature to cease, it'll change, it's not who I am. That's binding yourself to a teaching, that's orthodoxy. And orthopraxy is kind of remembering that. Now that's not kind of dogma, because dogma is just another set of attachment to dogma is just a set of beliefs which won't liberate you. So you certainly have a viewpoint in Buddhism. You know, you have a perspective which we call right understanding. But then, how do I apply that to those things which delude me? Those things which really feel like a sense of self. How do I remember? Not me. This is just a mood. It's conditioned. It's dependently originated. It arises, it ceases. How do I remember that? And then remembering that is orthodoxy and orthopraxy. It's the doing of right view. It's the doing of right understanding. And that takes faith. Not the faith of blind belief, but the trust that, that's how it works. That's how you get free. You don't believe anymore. You don't attach. You let go. And that lesson, I think, is relearned again and again and again and again in all kinds of ways. The path, I think, for most of us is kind of incremental, isn't it? I know it is for me. It's just like keep chipping away. Ajahn Sumedho says you've got to be like a rat gnawing through a wall. Just keep gnawing away. It's a pretty heavy image. But you have to really, you know, you just have to keep at it. You know, the mind tries to delude you into whatever. No. So like any sense of self that arises in that egotistical way, don't believe any of it. Just don't believe any of it. It's not who you are. No committee member. Don't be the chairperson or the treasurer. and then you really realize that the freedom of the heart is in the witnessing. Not the getting rid of, but also not the preoccupation with. So it's the sense of abiding as witness. One of the things I said last week, which I've been contemplating 2 weeks ago, is this paradox of awareness, where awareness participates in the sense experience, this experience of emotion and thought and so on, and yet it is distinct from it. And I was listening to a teacher I like on that, and it's a kind of interesting paradox, because if you just listen to sound, and you hear the subtle sounds that we have now, or if you just feel your hands, the awareness participates in the pressure and warmth of my hands, and yet it's distinct from it, isn't it? And it's kind of living that paradox all the time, that you find freedom. Because awareness is a part of it, and yet it's not it. So like with those difficult emotions you have, awareness knows that, and yet it's different from it. So when we talk about refuge, we talk about that refuge in the awareness rather than believing in the conditions, the emotions, the thoughts and such like. And that's again, that's practice, isn't it? It's something you do, you cultivate, you work on all the time. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection. Sadhu.